Tehran was the cosiest of the meetings between the big three, Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt. Stalin himself travelled with a tiny delegation, Molotov and Voroshilov, his official deputies in the negotiations, Beria as security overlord, Vlasik as head of personal security, and his physician, Professor Vinogradov. Stalin's bodyguard of 12 Georgians was led by Tsereteli, whom Westerners found good-looking, highly intelligent, and courteous. Nonetheless, there was something appropriate about the master of this Eastern Empire being protected by a guard of his fellow countrymen led by a cutthroat prince. Perhaps Churchill thought the same way, for his bodyguard there was made up of turbaned Sikhs with Tommy guns. As soon as Roosevelt arrived, Stalin invited him to move into the Soviet compound. The drive from the Soviet complex to the U.S. legation along narrow streets was impossible to guard. No doubt Beria was more concerned about Stalin's security than Roosevelt's. Soviet intelligence had allegedly uncovered a Nazi plot to assassinate the leaders. Stalin was also determined to separate the Westerners, whom he expected to gang up on him. It happened that this also suited Roosevelt's strategy to engage Stalin directly, without the British. Naturally, Beria bugged the presidential suite. Beria's handsome scientist son, Sergei, whom Stalin knew well, was among the Soviet eavesdroppers. Stalin summoned him. "How's your mother?" he asked, Nina Beria being a favorite. Small talk out of the way, he ordered Sergei to undertake the morally reprehensible and delicate mission of briefing him every morning. Stalin always quizzed him, even on Roosevelt's tone. Did he say that with conviction, or without enthusiasm? How did Roosevelt react? Stalin was surprised at the naivety of the Americans. Do they know we are listening to them? In fact, Roosevelt presumed that he was being bugged, but hoped the results might fortify Stalin's confidence in his honesty. Stalin sent word that he would call on the president, a meeting he had prepared for carefully, rehearsing strategies with Molotov and Beria, even down to where he would sit. Stalin, accompanied by Vlasik and Pavlov, his interpreter, and surrounded by his Georgian bodyguards, who walked 10 meters ahead and behind, as they did in the Kremlin, strode clumsily like a small bear out of his residence in his marshal's mustard-coloured summer tunic, with the gold star of the Order of Lenin on his chest, and across the compound to call on Roosevelt, the aristocratic blue-suited president, sitting erect in his wheelchair. Stalin stressed his need for the Second Front before Roosevelt established a rapport by criticizing the British Empire. India was ripe for a revolution from the bottom, like Russia, said FDR, who was as ill-informed about Leninism as he was about the Untouchables. Stalin showed that he knew more about India, replying that the question of castes was more complicated. This short tour d'horizon established the unlikely partnership between the two. Both legendarily charming when they wished to be, Stalin's fondness for Roosevelt was as genuine a diplomatic friendship as he ever managed with any imperialist. Stalin left Roosevelt to rest. At 4 p.m., the big three gathered round the specially constructed wedding feast table, in a big hall decorated in heavy imperial style. Stalin and Churchill agreed that Roosevelt was to chair the meeting. "As the youngest," joked the president. "In our hands," declaimed Churchill, "we have the future of mankind." "History has spoiled us," said Stalin. "She's given us very great power and very great opportunities. Let's begin our work." When they turned to the question of Operation Overlord, the invasion of France, Stalin complained that he had not expected to discuss military issues, so he had no military staff. "I've only got Marshal Voroshilov," he said rudely. "I hope he'll do." He then ignored Voroshilov and handled all military matters himself. Stalin insisted on the earliest preference for Overlord, the cross-channel invasion. Churchill was still unconvinced, preferring a preliminary Mediterranean operation, using troops already in the area. However, FDR was also committed to the channel. As a flustered Churchill realized, he was outvoted. Roosevelt winked at Stalin. The start of his gauche flirtation that greatly enhanced the Vost's position as arbiter of the Grand Alliance. Churchill handled Stalin much better by being himself. On the 29th, Stalin and Roosevelt met again. The Supremo knew from his briefing from Sergei Beria that his charm had worked. This allowed him to put pressure on Churchill. That morning, the President proposed the creation of an international organization that became the United Nations. Meanwhile, the generals were meeting with Voroshilov, who absolutely refused to understand the challenge of a cross-channel invasion, thinking it was like crossing a Russian river on a raft. Before the next session, Churchill took part in a solemn ceremony to celebrate Stalingrad. The officer of the British Guard handed a gleaming sword to Churchill, who, laying it across his hands, turned to Stalin. "I've been commanded by His Majesty King George VI to present to you this sword of honor. The blade of the sword bears the inscription, 'To the steel-hearted citizens of Stalingrad, a gift from King George VI, as a token of the homage of the British people.'" Churchill stepped forward and presented the sword to Stalin, who held it reverently in his hands for a long moment and then, with tears in his eyes, raised it to his lips and kissed it. "On behalf of the citizens of Stalingrad," he answered in a low, husky voice, "I wish to express my appreciation." He walked round to Roosevelt to show him the sword. The American read out the inscription. "Truly they had hearts of steel." Stalin handed the sword to Voroshilov, who dropped the scabbard with a crash. The bungling cavalryman, who had charged waving his saber many a time, had managed to introduce comedy into the most solemn moment of Stalin's international career. The delegations moved back to the round table for the next session. As ever, Stalin made sure that he arrived last. Always smoking and doodling wolf heads on a pad, Stalin was never agitated, rarely gestured, and seldom consulted Molotov and Voroshilov, but he kept up the pressure on Churchill for the second front. "Do the British really believe in Overlord, or are you only saying so to reassure the Russians?" When he heard that the Allies had not yet agreed on a commander, he growled, "Then nothing will come of these operations." Finally, when Churchill would not give a date, Stalin suddenly got to his feet and, turning to Molotov and Voroshilov, said, "Let's not waste our time here. We've got plenty to do at the front." Roosevelt managed to pour unction on troubled waters. That night, it was Stalin's turn to host a banquet in the usual Soviet style, with an unbelievable quantity of food. Stalin drank little, but got his kicks by needling Churchill, exchanges in which Roosevelt seemed to take an undignified pleasure. Stalin sneered that he was glad Churchill was not a liberal, that most loathsome of creatures in the Bolshevik lexicon. But he then tested Churchill by joking that 50,000, or perhaps 100,000, German officers should be executed. Churchill was furious, knocking over his glass so the brandy spread across the table. He growled, "Such an attitude is contrary to the British sense of justice. The British Parliament and public would never support the execution of honest men who had fought for their country." Roosevelt quipped that he would like to compromise. Only 49,000 should be shot. Elliot Roosevelt, the president's ne'er-do-well son, jumped tipsily to his feet to Josh, "Wouldn't the 50,000 fall in battle anyway?" "To your health, Elliot." Stalin clinked glasses with him. But Churchill snarled at Elliot. "Are you interested in damaging relations between the Allies? How dare you?" He headed for the door, but as he reached it, hands were clapped on my shoulders from behind, and there was Stalin, with Molotov at his side, both grinning broadly and eagerly declaring that they were only playing. Stalin has a very captivating manner when he chooses to use it. Roosevelt's deference to Stalin and shabbiness to Churchill were both unseemly and counterproductive. Heartiness was restored by Stalin. "Come here, Molotov, and tell us about your pact with Hitler." The conference finale was Churchill's 69th birthday dinner. Stalin toasted, "To Churchill, my fighting friend, if it is possible to consider Mr. Churchill my friend," and then walked round to clink glasses with the Englishman, putting his arm around his shoulders. Churchill answered, "To Stalin the Great." When Churchill joked that Britain was becoming pinker, Stalin responded, "A sign of good health." At the final meetings next day, Roosevelt explained privately to Stalin that since he had a presidential election coming up, he could not discuss Poland. The subordination of the fate of that country to American politics can only have encouraged Stalin's plans for a tame Poland. It was a sign of the amateurism and immediacy of this intimate conference that Churchill and Stalin discussed Polish borders using a map torn out of The Times. On the 2nd of December, Stalin, satisfied that the Allies had finally promised to launch Overlord in the spring, left Tehran for Stalingrad, his only post-battle visit to the city that had played such a decisive role in his life. His limousine drove too fast down the narrow streets, colliding with a woman driver who almost expired when she recognized Stalin. He got out and calmed her. "Don't cry, it's not your fault. Blame the war. Our car's armored and didn't suffer. You can repair yours." Afterwards, he headed back to Moscow.